center of the Black Island. Tom hadn't realized until now that it was an extinct volcano, but from here it was obvious. The steep, black crags ringed an almost circular bowl of land, green and patched with fields. Almost directly below the place where the pirates crouched, a small static settlement stood beside a blue lake. There were airship hangars and mooring masts beside the stone buildings, and on the flat ground behind them, dwarfing the whole place, Air Haven perched on 100 skinny landing legs, looking as helpless as a grounded bird.
"The Air Caravanserai," chuckled Peavy.
He pulled out his telescope and put it to his eye.
"Look at 'em work. They're pumping their gas bags back up, desperate to get back into the sky."
He swung the glass quickly across the surrounding hillsides.
"No sign of any of our boys. Oh, if only we had a cannon left. But we'll manage, eh, lads? A bunch of airy fairies is no match for us. Come on, let's get closer."
There was a strange edge to the mayor's voice. "He's frightened," Tom realized. "But he can't admit it, in case Mungo and Mags and Ames lose faith in him." He had never thought he would feel sorry for the pirate mayor, but he did. Peavy had been kind to him, in his way, and it hurt to see him reduced to this, scrambling across the wet ground with his people muttering and cursing him behind his back. They still followed him, though, down between the screes into the crater of the old fire mountain. Once they saw riders silhouetted on a distant crag, a patrol of islanders hunting for survivors from the sunken pirate town. Once an airship flew low overhead, and Peavy hissed at everybody to lie flat and stay still, wrapping his monkey under his robes to muffle its shrill complaints. The airship circled, but by that time the sun had gone down, and the pilot did not see the figures who cowered in the twilight before him like mice hiding from an owl. He flew back down to land at the caravanserai as a fat moon heaved itself over the eastern crags. Tom gave a sharp sob of relief and scrambled up. Around him, the others were also starting to move, grunting, dislodging small stones that went clattering away down the hillside. He could see people hurrying about with lanterns and torches in the streets of the Air Caravanserai, and lamp-lit windows that made him think how wonderful it would be to be warm and safe indoors. Air Haven was bright with electric lights, and the wind brought the distant sounds of shouted orders, music, cheering.
"For Pete's sake,"
hissed Mungo,
"we're too late. He's leaving."
"Never,"
scoffed Peavy. But they could all see that Air Haven's gas bags were almost full. A few minutes later, the growl of its engines came rumbling up the slope, rising and falling as the wind gusted. The flying town was straining upward, its crab-like legs folding back into place underneath it.
"No!"
shouted Peavy. Then he was running downhill, scrambling and tumbling down clattering spills of scree toward the flat, boggy land in the crater floor, and as he ran, they heard him screaming,
"Come back! You're my catch! I sank my town for you!"
Mungo and Mags and Ames set off after him, with Hester and Tom behind. At the foot of the slope, the ground grew soft and squashy underfoot, and pools of water reflected the moon and the lights of the rising town.
"Come back!"
they could hear Peavy shouting somewhere ahead of them.
"Come back!"
And then,
"Ah! Oh! Help!"
They hurried toward the sound of his voice, and the harsh screams of the monkey. And all came to a halt together at the edge of a deep patch of bog. Peavy was already up to his waist in it, the monkey perched on top of his head like a sailor on a foundering ship, grinning with fear.
"Give me a hand, boys,"
the mayor pleaded.
"Help me. We can still get it. It's only testing its lifting engines. It'll come down again."
The pirates watched him silently. They knew they had no chance of taking the flying town, and that his shouts had probably warned the islanders of their presence.
"We've got to help him,"
whispered Tom, starting forward, but Hester held him back.
Too late,
she said. Peavy was sinking deeper, the weight of his chain of office pulling him down. He spluttered as the black mud swilled into his mouth.
Come on, lads, Mags, Mungo, I'm your mayor. I done all this for you.
He searched for Tom with wild, terrified eyes.
Tell them, Tommy boy,
he whimpered.
Tell them I wanted to make Tunbridge Wheels great. I wanted to be respectable. Tell them.
Mungo's first shot blew the monkey off the top of Peavy's head in a cloud of singed fur. The second and third went through his chest. He bowed his head, and the mud gulped him down with soft, farting noises. The pirates turned to look at Tom.
"We probably wouldn't be here if it weren't for you,"
muttered Mungo.
"If you hadn't gone filling the chief's head up with all them ideas about manors and cities and stuff," agreed Mags.
"Different forks for every course, and no talking with your mouth full,"
sneered Ames. Tom started to back away. To his surprise, Hester stepped quickly between him and the pirates.
"It's not Tom's fault," she said.
"And you're no use to us neither,"
Mungo growled.
"Neither of you is. We're pirates. We don't need no lessons in etiquette, and we don't need no lame scar-faced girl to hold us up."
He raised his gun, and Mags followed suit. Even Mr. Ames pulled out a little revolver. And a voice out of the darkness said,
"They're mine."
Chapter 21. In the Engineerium. London was climbing toward a high plateau where the town-torn earth was dusted with thin layers of snow. Far behind it, but not nearly far enough, rolled Panzerstadt Bayreuth, not just a threatening blur on the horizon anymore, but a huge dark mass of tracks and tiers, the gold filigree work of its ornate top deck clearly visible above the smoke of factories and engines. Londoners crowded onto the aft observation platforms and watched in silence as the gap between the two cities slowly narrowed. That afternoon, the Lord Mayor announced that there was no need for panic and that the Guild of Engineers would bring the city safely through this crisis. But there had already been riots and looting on the lower tiers, and squads of beefeaters had been sent down to keep order in the gut.
"Old Crome doesn't know what he's talking about," muttered one of the men on duty at the Quirk Circus elevator station that evening. "I never thought I'd hear myself say it. But he's a fool, bringing poor old London way out east like this, day after day of travelling, week after week, just to get scoffed by some big old conurbation. I wish Valentine was here. He'd know what to do."
"Quiet, Bert," hissed his companion. "Here comes some more of 'em."
Both men bowed politely as two engineers strode up to the turnstiles. A young man and a girl, dressed identically in green glastic goggles and white rubber hoods and coats. The girl flashed a gold pass. When she and her companion had gone up into the waiting elevator, Bert turned to his friend and whispered,
"It must be important, this do at the Engineerium. They've been swarming up out of their nests in the deep gut like a load of old white maggots. Imagine having a guild meeting at a time like this."
Inside the elevator, Catherine sat down next to Bevis Pod, already feeling hot and self-conscious inside the coat that he had lent her. She glanced at him, and then checked her reflection in the window, making sure that the red wheels they had drawn so carefully on each other's foreheads had not gotten smudged. She thought they both looked ridiculous in these hoods and goggles. But Bevis had assured her that a lot of engineers wore them these days. And the other occupant of the elevator, a fat navigator, didn't so much as look at them while the car lurched toward top tier. Catherine had spent the whole day restlessly waiting for Bevis to arrive with her disguise. To while away the time, she had looked up the name Hester Shaw in the indices of all her father's books, but couldn't find it. A complete catalogue of the London Museum contained one brief reference to a Pandora Shaw, but it just said she was an out-country scavenger who had supplied a few minor fossils and pieces of old tech to the Historians Guild, and gave the date of her death 7 years ago. After that, she tried looking up Medusa, only to learn that it was some sort of monster in an old story. She didn't think Magnus Chrome and his engineers believed in monsters. Nobody gave a second glance as she and Bevis strode across Top Tier toward the main entrance of the Engineerium. Scores of engineers were already hurrying up the steps. Catherine joined them, clutching her gold pass and keeping close to the apprentice, terrified that she might lose him in this crowd of identical white coats. "This will never work," she kept thinking. But the guildsman on duty at the door wasn't bothering to look at passes. She took a last look at the fading sunset behind the dome of St. Paul's, then stepped inside. It was bigger than she expected, and brighter, lit by hundreds of argon globes that hung in the great open shaft at the center of the building, like planets hanging in space. She looked around for the staircase, but Bevis tugged at her arm and said,
"We go up by monorail. Look!"
The engineers were clambering into little monorail cars. Catherine and Bevis joined the line, listening to their muttered conversations and the squeaky rustle of their coats rubbing together. Bevis's eyes were wide and frightened behind his goggles. Catherine had hoped that they would be able to get a monorail car to themselves so that they could talk. But more engineers were arriving all the time, and she ended up sitting on the far side of a packed car from him, wedged tightly in with a group from the Maglev Research Division.
"Where are you from, guildsperson?" asked the man sitting beside her.
Catherine looked frantically at Bevis, but he was too far away to whisper an answer. She blurted out the first thing that came to mind. "K Division."
"Old Twixie, eh?" said the man. "I hear she's having amazing results with her new models."
"Oh, yes, very," she replied. Then the car moved off with a lurch, and her neighbour turned to the window, fascinated by the passing view. Catherine had expected the monorail to feel like an elevator, but the speed and the spiralling movement made it quite different, and for a moment she had to concentrate hard on not being sick. The other engineers seemed not to notice.
"What do you think the Lord Mayor's speech will be about?" one of them asked.
"It must be Medusa," said another.
"I heard they are preparing for a test."
"Let's hope it works," said a woman sitting just in front of Catherine. "It was Valentine who found the machine after all, and he's only a historian, you know. You can't trust them."
"Oh, Valentine is the Lord Mayor's man," said another. "Don't let that Historians Guild mark fool you. He's as loyal as a dog, so long as we give him plenty of money and he gets to pretend that foreign daughter of his is a high London lady."
Around and around they went, and up past offices and workshops full of busy engineers, like an enormous hive of insects. The car stopped on level 5, and Catherine climbed out, still flushed with anger at what the others had said. She linked up with Bevis again, and they all trotted together along chilly, white corridors and through hanging curtains of transparent plastic. She could hear the babble of voices ahead, and after a few twists and turns, they emerged into an immense auditorium. Bevis led the way to a seat near one of the exits. She looked around to see if she could spot Supervisor Nimmo, but it was impossible to make him out. The auditorium was a sea of white coats and bald or hooded heads, and more were pouring through the entrances all the time.
"Look,"
hissed Bevis, nudging her.
"That's Dr. Twix, the one I told you about."
He pointed to a squat little barrel-shaped woman who was taking a seat in the front row, chattering animatedly with her neighbours.
All the top guilds persons are here. Twix, Chubb, Garstang, and there's Dr. Vambrace, the head of security.
Catherine began to feel frightened. If she had been unmasked at the door, she might have been able to pass it off as a silly prank. But now she was deep in the engineer's inner sanctum, and she could tell that something important was about to happen. She reminded herself that even if they discovered her, the engineers would never dare harm Thaddeus Valentine's daughter. She tried not to think about what they might do to Bevis. At last the doors were closed and the lights dimmed. An expectant hush filled the auditorium, broken only by the slithery whisper of 500 engineers rising to their feet. Catherine and Bevis jumped up with them, peering at the stage over the shoulders of the people in front. Magnus Chrome was standing at a metal lectern, his cold eyes sweeping the audience. For a moment he seemed to stare straight at Catherine, and she had to remind herself that he couldn't possibly recognize her, not with her hood and her goggles and the tall collar of her coat turned up.
"You may be seated," said Chrome,
and waited until they had settled themselves before going on.
"This is a glorious day for our guild, my friends."
A ripple of excitement ran through the auditorium, and through Catherine, too. Chrome motioned for quiet. Up in the ceiling of the auditorium, a slide projector whirred into life, and a picture appeared on a screen behind his head. It was a diagram of an enormous, complicated machine.
"Medusa," announced Chrome,
and there was a sort of echo as all the engineers sighed, "Medusa."
"As some of you already know," he went on, "Medusa is an experimental energy weapon from the 60-Minute War. We have known about it for some time, in fact, ever since Valentine found these documents on his trip to America 20 years ago.
The projector screen was flickering with faded diagrams and spidery writing.
"Father never told me that," Catherine thought.
"Of course, these fragmentary plans were not enough to let us reconstruct Medusa," Chrome was saying. "But 7 years ago, thanks again to Valentine, we acquired a remarkable piece of old tech taken from a long-lost military site in the American desert. It is perhaps the best-preserved ancient computer core ever discovered. And it is more than that. It is the brain of Medusa, the artificial intelligence that once powered this remarkable machine. Thanks to the hard work of Dr. Splay and his comrades in B Division, we have at last been able to restore it to working order. Guildspersons, the days when London had to run and hide from other hungry cities are at an end. With Medusa at our command, we will be able to reduce any one of them to ashes in the blink of an eye."
The engineers applauded wildly, and Bevis Pod nudged at Catherine to join in, but her hands seemed to have become frozen to the metal armrests of her seat. She felt giddy with shock. She remembered everything she had heard about the 60-Minute War, and how the ancients' terrible thunder weapons had blasted their static cities and poisoned the earth and sky. Father would never have helped the engineers to recreate such a terrible thing.
"Nor will we have to go chasing after scraps like Salthook," Chrome continued. "In another week, London will be within range of Batmunk Gompa, the shield wall. For 1,000 years, the Anti-Traction League has cowered behind it, holding out against the tide of history. Medusa will destroy it at a single stroke. The lands beyond it, with all their huge, static cities, their crops and forests, their untapped mineral wealth, will become London's new hunting ground."
You could hardly hear him now. The cheers of the engineers rolled like breakers against the wall behind him, and it slid slowly open, revealing a long window that looked out towards St. Paul's Cathedral and the turrets of the Guildhall.
"But first," he shouted, "we have more pressing business to attend to. Although I had hoped we might keep Medusa hidden until we reached the shield wall, it has become necessary to give a demonstration of its power. Even as I speak, Dr. Splay's team is preparing a test firing of the new weapon."
Even if Catherine had wanted to hear more, it would soon have become impossible, for Chrome's audience were all talking excitedly among themselves. A few engineers, presumably those connected with the Medusa project, were hurrying to the exits. Standing up, Catherine started pushing her way to the door. A moment later, she was out in the antiseptic corridor, wondering what to do next.
"Kate?"
Bevis Pod appeared behind her.
"Where are you going? People noticed you leave. I saw some guild security people watching us."
"We've got to get out of here," whispered Catherine.
"Where's the way out?"
"I don't know,"
admitted the boy.
"I've never been to this level before. I suppose we'll have to find our way back to the monorail."
He shook Catherine away as she tried to take his hand.
"No, somebody will see. Engineers aren't supposed to touch each other."
They hurried along the tubular corridors, and Catherine said,
"Croom was lying. My father didn't go to America 7 years ago. He just went on a little trip to the islands of the Western Ocean. And he never told me he'd found anything important. He'd have told me if he'd really found Medusa. He wouldn't want anything to do with old world weapons anyway."
"But why would the Lord Mayor lie?"
asked Bevis, who was secretly rather pleased that his guild had stumbled upon the keys to yet another ancient secret.
"Anyway, he didn't say your dad went to America for this thing. He just said he acquired it. Maybe he bought it from a scavenger or something. I wonder what Chrome meant about a demonstration."
He stopped. They had come to the end of the corridor, and there were no monorails in sight. Three doorways faced them. Two were locked. The third led only onto a narrow balcony that jutted out from the Engineerium's flank, high above Paternoster Square.
"What now?"
asked Catherine, hearing her own voice high and thin with fright, and Bevis just as nervously replied,
"I don't know."
She stepped out onto the balcony to catch her breath. The moon was up, but veiled by thin clouds, and a cool drizzle was falling. She pulled off her goggles and let the rain spill down her face, glad to be free of the heat and the chemical stench. She thought about Father. Had he really found Medusa? Bevis was right. Chrome had no reason to lie. Poor Father. He would be in the air now, somewhere above the snow peaks of Shanguo. If only she had some way to warn him what they were planning to do with his discovery. A low mechanical rumble came drifting across the moonlit square. She looked down at the wet deck plates, but could not see what was making the noise. Then something made her glance up at St. Paul's. She gasped.
"Bevis, look!"
Slowly, like a huge bud blooming, the dome of the ancient cathedral was splitting open. Chapter 22 Shrike. Had the Stalker only just arrived, or had he been standing watching them squabble, dark and still, on the stone-strewn hillside, like a stone himself? He took a step forward, and the damp grass smouldered where he set his foot.
"They are mine."
The pirates swung around, Mags's machine gun spraying streams of tracer at the Iron Man, while Mungo's hand cannon punched black holes in his armor, and Ames blazed away with his revolver. Caught in the web of gunfire, Shrike stood, swaying for a moment. Then, slowly, like a man walking into a strong wind, he started forward. Bullets sparked off his armor, and his coat tore away in rags and tatters. The holes the cannon made spewed something that might have been blood, might have been oil. He stretched out his arms, and an iron claw was ripped away, and another. Then he reached Mags, and she made a choking sound, and went backward into the bracken and down. Ames flung down his gun and turned to run, but Shrike was suddenly behind him, and he stopped short, gawping at a handful of red spikes that sprouted from his chest. Mungo's gun was empty. He threw it aside and pulled his sword out, but before he could swing it, Shrike had grabbed him by the hair and wrenched his head back and severed his neck with one scything blow.
"Tom," said Hester.
"Run!"
Shrike flung the head aside and stalked forward, and Tom ran. He didn't want to. He knew there was no point, and he knew he should stand by Hester, but his legs had other ideas. His whole body wanted only to be away from the terrible dead thing that was coming toward him down the hill. Then the ground gave way under him. He plunged into cold mud and fell, rolled over, and came to a rest against an outcrop of stone on the edge of the same mire that had swallowed Chrysler Peavy. He looked back. The Stalker stood among the sprawling bodies. Airhaven was overhead, testing its engines one by one, and its lights kindled cold reflections on his moon-silvered skull. Hester stood facing him, bravely holding her ground. Tom thought,
"She's trying to save me. She's buying time so that I can get away. But I can't just let him kill her. I can't."
Ignoring the countless voices of his body that were still screaming at him to run, he started to crawl back up the hill.
"Hester-da-da-da-shaw,"
he heard Shrike say, and the voice slurred and caught like a faulty recording. Steam hissed from holes in the Stalker's chest, and black ichor dripped from him and bubbled at the corners of his mouth.
"Are you going to kill me?"
the girl asked. Shrike nodded his great head, just once.
"For a little while."
"What do you mean?"
The long mouth dragged sideways, smiling.
"We are two of a kind, you and I. I knew it as soon as I found you that day on the shore, after you left me. The loneliness."
"I had to go, Shrike," she whispered. "I wasn't part of your collection."
"You were very dear to me."
"Something's wrong with him,"
thought Tom, inching up the hill. Stalkers weren't meant to have feelings. He remembered what he had been taught about the resurrected men all going mad. Was that seaweed hanging from the ducts on Shrike's head? Had his brains gone rusty? Sparks were flickering inside his chest, behind the bullet holes.
"Hester,"
Shrike grated, falling heavily to his knees so that his face was at the same level as hers.
"Chrome has made me a promise. His servants have learned the secret of my construction."
Fear prickled the back of Tom's neck.
"I will take your body to London,"
Shrike told the girl.
"Chrome will resurrect you as an iron woman. Your flesh will be replaced with steel, your nerves with wire, your thoughts with electricity. You will be beautiful. You will be my companion for all time."
"Shrike," Hester snorted. "Chrome won't want me resurrected."
"Why not? No one will recognize you in your new body. You will have no memories, no feelings. You will be no threat to him. But I will remember for you, my daughter. We will hunt down Valentine together.
Hester laughed. A strange, mad, terrible sound that set Tom's teeth on edge as he reached the place where Mungo's body lay. The heavy sword was still clamped in the pirate's fist, and Tom reached out and started prying it free. Glancing up, he saw that Hester had taken a step closer to the stalker. She tilted her head back, baring her throat, readying herself for his claws. "All right," she said. "But let Tom go."
"He must die," insisted Shrike. "It is part of my bargain with Chrome. You will not remember him when you wake in your new body."
"Oh, please, Shrike, no," begged Hester. "Tell Chrome he escaped, or drowned, or something, died somewhere in the outcountry, and you couldn't bring him back. Please."
Tom clung to the sword, its hilt still clammy with Mungo's sweat. Now that the moment had come, he was so scared that he could barely breathe, let alone stand up and confront the stalker.
"I can't do this," he thought. "I'm a historian, not a warrior."
But he couldn't desert Hester, not while she was bargaining away her life for his. He was close enough to see the fear in her eye and the sharp glitter of Shrike's claws as he reached for her.
"Very well," the stalker said.
Gently, he stroked Hester's face with the tips of the blades.
"The boy can live."
The hand drew back to strike. Hester shut her eye.
"Shrike!"
howled Tom, hurling himself up and forward with the sword held out stiffly in front of him, feeling the green light spill across his face as Shrike spun, hissing to meet him. An iron arm lashed out, hurling him backward. He felt a searing pain in his chest, and for a moment he was sure that he had been torn in two. But it was the stalker's forearm that struck him, not the bladed hand. And he landed in one piece and rolled over, gasping at the pain, expecting to see Shrike lunge at him, and then nothing ever again. But Shrike was on the ground, and Hester was bending over him. And as Tom watched, the stalker's eye flickered, and something exploded inside him with a flash and a crack and a coil of smoke leaking upward. The hilt of the sword jutted from one of the gashes in his chest, crackling with blue sparks.
"Oh, Shrike," whispered Hester.
Shrike carefully sheathed his claws so that she could take his hand. Unexpected memories fluttered through his disintegrating mind, and he suddenly knew who he had been before they dragged him onto the resurrection slab to make a stalker of him. He wanted to tell Hester, and he lifted his great iron head toward her, but before he could force the words out, his death was upon him, and it was no easier this time than the last. The great iron carcass settled into stillness, and smoke blew away on the wind. Down in the valley, horns were blowing, and Tom could see a party of riders starting up the hill from the caravanserai, alerted by the sound of gunfire. They carried spears and flaming torches, and he didn't think they would be friendly. He tried to push himself upright, but the pain in his chest almost made him faint. Hester heard him groan and swung toward him.
"What did you do that for?"
she shouted. Tom could not have been more surprised if she had slapped him.
He was going to kill you," he protested.
"He was going to make me like him," screamed Hester, hugging Shrike. "Didn't you hear what he said? He was going to make me everything I ever wanted. No memories, no feelings. Imagine Valentine's face when I came for him. Oh, why do you keep interfering? He would have turned you into a monster.
Tom heard his own voice rising to a shout as all his pain and fear flared into anger.
I'm already a monster, she shrieked. No, you're not.
Tom managed to heave himself to his knees.
You're my friend, he shouted. I hate you. I hate you,
Hester was yelling.
Well, I care about you, whether you like it or not,
Tom screamed.
Do you think you're the only person who's lost their mum and dad? I feel just as angry and lonely as you. But you don't see me going around wanting to kill people and trying to get myself turned into a stalker. You're just a rude, self-pitying...
But the rest of what he had been planning to tell her died away in an astonished sob, because suddenly he could see the town below him and Airhaven and the approaching riders as clearly as if it were the middle of the day. He saw the stars fade. He saw Hester's face freeze in mid-shout with spittle trailing from the corners of her mouth. He saw his own wavering shadow dancing on the blood-soaked grass. Above the crags, the night sky was filling with an unearthly light, as if a new sun had risen from the outcountry, somewhere far away toward the north. Chapter 23 Medusa. Catherine watched, transfixed, as the dome of St. Paul's split along black seams and the sections folded outward like petals. Inside, something was rising slowly up a central tower and opening as it rose, an orchid of cold white metal. The grumble of vast hydraulics echoed across the square and shivered through the fabric of the engineerium.
Medusa,
whispered Bevis Pod, standing behind her in the open doorway.
They haven't really been repairing the cathedral at all. They've built Medusa inside St. Paul's.
Guilds persons?
They turned. An engineer was standing behind them.
What are you doing? He snapped. This gantry is off limits to everyone but L Division.
He stopped, staring at Catherine. And she saw that Bevis was staring too, his dark eyes wide and horrified. For a moment she couldn't imagine what was wrong with him. Then she understood. The rain. She had forgotten about the guild mark he had painted so carefully between her eyebrows, and now it was trickling down her face in thin red rills.
"What in Quirk's name?" the engineer gasped.
"Kate, run!"
shouted Bevis, pushing the engineer aside, and Catherine ran, and heard the man's angry shout behind her as he fell. Then Bevis was with her, grabbing her by the hand, darting left and right down empty corridors until a stairway opened ahead. Down one flight and then another, and behind them they heard more shouts and the sudden jarring peal of an alarm bell. Then they were at the bottom, in a small lobby, somewhere at the rear of the engineerium. There were big glass doors opening onto top tier, and two guildsmen standing guard.
"There's an intruder," panted Bevis, pointing back the way they had come. "On the third floor. I think he's armed."
The guildsmen were already startled by the sudden ringing of the alarm bell. They exchanged shocked glances. Then one started up the stairs, dragging a gas pistol from his belt. Bevis and Catherine seized their chance and hurried on.
"My colleague's been hurt,"
explained Bevis, pointing at Catherine's red-streaked face.
"I'm taking her around to the infirmary."
The door swung open and spilled them out into the welcome dark. They ran as fast as they could into the shadow of St. Paul's, then stopped and listened. Catherine could hear the heavy throbbing of machinery, and a closer, louder throb that was the beat of her own heart. A man's voice was shouting orders somewhere, and there was a crash of armored feet coming closer.
"Beefeaters," she whimpered. "They'll want to see our papers. They'll take off my hood. Oh, Bevis, I should never have asked you to get me in there. Run! Leave me!
Bevis looked at her and shook his head. He had defied his guild and risked everything to help her, and he wasn't about to abandon her now.
Oh, Cleo, help us,
breathed Catherine, and something made her glance toward Paternoster Square. There was old Chudley Pomeroy, standing on the Guildhall steps with his arms full of envelopes and folders, staring upward. She had never been so happy to see anyone in her whole life, and she ran to him, dragging Bevis Pod along with her, and calling softly,
"Mr. Pomeroy!"
He looked blankly at them, then gasped in surprise as Catherine pulled the stupid hood off, and he saw her face and her sweat-draggled hair.
"Miss Valentine, what in Quirk's name is happening? Look what those damned interfering engineers have done to St. Paul's!"
She looked up. The metal orchid was open to its full extent now, casting a deep shadow on the square below. Only it was not an orchid. It was a cowled, flaring thing, like the hood of some enormous cobra, and it was swinging around to point at Panzerstadt Bayreuth.
"Medusa," she said.
"Who?"
asked Chudley Pomeroy. A bug siren wailed.
"Oh, please," she cried, turning to the plump historian. "They're after us. If they catch Bevis, I don't know what will happen to him."
Bless him. He did not say why or what have you done wrong. Just took Catherine by one arm and Bevis Pod by the other and hurried them toward the Guildhall garage where his bug was waiting. As the chauffeur helped them into it, a squad of beefeaters came clattering past, but they paid no attention to Pomeroy and his companions. He hid Catherine's coat and hood behind his seat and made Bevis Pod crouch down on the floor of the bug. Then he squeezed himself in beside Catherine on the back seat and said,
"Let me do the talking,"
as the bug went purring out into Paternoster Square. There was a throng of people outside the elevator station, gazing up in amazement at the thing that had sprouted from St. Paul's. Beefeaters stopped the bug while a young engineer peered in. Pomeroy opened a vent in the glastic lid and asked,
"Is there a problem, guildsman?"
"A break-in at the Engineerium, anti-tractionist terrorists."
"Well, don't look at us," laughed Pomeroy. "I've been working in my office at the Guild Hall all evening, and Miss Valentine has been kindly helping me to sort out some papers."
"All the same, sir, I'll have to search your bug."
"Oh, really?" cried Pomeroy. "Do we look like terrorists? Haven't you got better things to do on the last night of London, with a dirty great conurbation bearing down on us? I shall complain to the council in the strongest possible terms. It's outrageous."
The man looked uncertain, then nodded, and stepped aside to let Pomeroy's chauffeur steer the bug into a waiting freight elevator. As the doors closed behind it, Pomeroy let out a sigh of relief.
"Those damned engineers. Oh, no offence, Apprentice Pod."
"None taken,"
said Bevis's muffled voice from somewhere below.
"Thank you,"
whispered Catherine.
"Oh, thank you for helping us."
"Oh, don't mention it," chuckled Pomeroy. "I'm always happy to do anything that upsets Chrome and his lackeys. Thousands of years old, that cathedral, and they go and turn it into whatever they've turned it into, without so much as a by your leave."
He looked nervously at Catherine and saw that she wasn't really listening. Gently, he asked,
"But whatever have you done to stir them up, Miss Valentine? You don't have to tell me if you don't want to, but if you and your friend are in trouble, and if there's anything an old coot like me can do..."
Catherine felt helpless tears prickling her eyes.
"Please," she whispered, "could you just take us home?"
"Of course."
They sat in awkward silence as the bug drove through the streets of Tier 1 into the park. The darkness was full of people running and shouting, pointing up toward the cathedral. But there were other runners, too. engineer security men leading squads of beefeaters. When the bug stopped outside Cleo House, Pomeroy climbed out to walk Catherine to the door. She whispered a heartfelt goodbye to Bevis and followed him.
"Could you take Apprentice Pod to an elevator station?" she asked. "He needs to get back to the gut."
Pomeroy looked worried.
"I don't know, Miss Valentine," he sighed. "You've seen how het up the engineers are. If I do them, they'll have all their factories and dormitory blocks locked down tight by now, and security checks in progress. They may already have worked out that he's missing, along with two coats and hoods."
"You mean he can't go back?"
Catherine felt dizzy at the thought of what she had done to poor Pod.
"Not ever."
Pomeroy nodded.
"Then I'll keep him with me at Cleo House," Catherine decided.
"He's not a stray cat, my dear."
"But when Father gets home, he'll be able to sort everything out, won't he? Explain to the Lord Mayor that it was nothing to do with Bevis."
"It's possible,"
agreed Pomeroy.
"Your father is very close to the Guild of Engineers. A damn sight too close, some people say. But I don't think Cleo House is the place to keep your friend. I'll take him down to the museum. There's plenty of room for him there, and the engineers won't be able to search for him without giving us warning first."
"Would you really do that?"
asked Catherine, afraid that she was dragging yet another innocent person into the trouble she had created. But after all, it would only be for a few days, until Father came home. Then everything would be all right.
"Oh, thank you,"
she said happily, standing on tiptoe to kiss Pomeroy's cheek.
"Thank you."
Pomeroy blushed and beamed at her, and started to say something else, but although his mouth moved, she could not hear the words. Her head was filled with a strange sound, a whining roar that grew louder and louder until she realized that it wasn't inside her at all, but pounding down from somewhere overhead.
"Look!"
shouted the historian, pointing upward. Her fear had made her forget St. Paul's. Now, looking up at top tier, she saw the cobra hood of Medusa start to crackle with violet lightning. The hair on her arms and the back of her neck prickled, and when she reached for Pomeroy's hand, pale sparks jumped between the tips of her fingers and his robes.
"Mr. Pomeroy," she shouted, "what's happening?"
"Great quirk," the historian cried. "What have those fools awoken now?"
Ghostly spheres of light detached themselves from the glowing machine and drifted down over Circle Park like fire balloons. Lightning danced around the spires of the Guildhall. The rushing, whining roar grew louder and louder, higher and higher, until even with her hands clapped over her ears, Catherine felt she could not bear a moment more of it. Then, quite suddenly, a stream of incandescent energy burst from the cobra's hood and stretched northward, a snarling, spitting cat-o'-nine-tails lashing out to lick at the upper works of Panzerstadt Bayreuth. The night split apart and went rushing away to hide in the corners of the sky. For a second, Catherine saw the tiers of the distant conurbation limned in fire, and then it was gone. A pulse of brightness lifted from the earth, blinding white, then red, a pillar of fire rushing up in silence into the sky, and across the flame-lit snow, the sound wave came rolling, a low, long-drawn-out boom, as if a great door had slammed shut somewhere in the depths of the earth. The beam snapped off, plunging Circle Park into sudden darkness, and in the silence she heard Dog howling madly inside the house.
"Great quirk," Pomeroy whispered. "All those poor people."
"No," Catherine heard herself say. "Oh, no, no, no."
She started to run across the garden, staring toward the lightning-flecked cloud that wreathed the wreckage of the conurbation. From Circle Park and all the observation platforms came the sound of wordless voices, and she thought at first that they were crying out in horror the way she wanted to. But no, they were cheering, cheering, cheering. Part 2 Chapter 24 An Agent of the League. The strange light in the north had died away, and the long thunderclap had spent itself, echoing and re-echoing from the walls of the old volcano. Mastering their panicked horses, the men of the Black Island came on along the margins of the bog amid a drumroll of galloping hooves and the torn silk sound of wind-blown torches. Tom raised his hands and shouted, "We're friends, not pirates, travellers, from London!" But the horsemen were in no mood to listen, even the few who understood. They had been hunting survivors from the sunken suburb all day. They had seen what Peavy's pirates had done in the fishing villages along the western shore, and now they shouted to one another in their own language and galloped closer, raising their bows. A grey feathered arrow thudded into the ground at Tom's feet, making him stumble backward. "We're friends!" he shouted again. The leading man drew his sword, but another rider spurred in front of him, shouting something in the island tongue, then in English. "I want them alive!" It was Anna Fang. She reined in her horse, swung herself down from the saddle, and ran toward Tom and Hester, her coat flapping against the firelight like a red flag. She wore a sword in a long scabbard on her back, and on her breast Tom saw a bronze badge in the shape of a broken wheel, the symbol of the Anti-Traction League.
"Tom, Hester,"
she hugged them one by one, smiling her sweetest smile.
"I thought you were dead. I sent Lindstrom and Yasmina to look for you, the morning after the fight at Airhaven. They found your balloon wrecked in those horrible marshes, and said you must be dead. Dead. I wanted to search for your poor bodies, but the Jenny had been damaged, and I was so busy helping guide the town down to the repair yard here. But we said prayers for you, and made funeral sacrifices to the gods of the sky. Do you think we could ask them for a refund?"
Tom kept quiet. His chest was hurting so that he could hardly breathe, let alone speak. Anyway, the badge on the aviatrix's coat told him that Peavy's stories had been true. She was an agent of the League. He wasn't charmed any more by her kindness and her tinkling laugh. She shouted something over her shoulder to the waiting riders, and a couple jumped down from their ponies and led them forward, staring in wonder at Shrike's corpse.
"I have to leave you for a while," she explained. "I'm taking the Jenny north to see what devilry has lit up the sky. The islanders will look after you. Can you ride?"
Tom had never even seen a horse before, let alone sat on one, but he was so dazed with pain and shock that he could not protest as they heaved him up into the saddle of a shaggy little pony and started to lead it downhill. He looked back for Hester and saw her scowling at him, hunched in the saddle of a second pony. Then the knot of riders closed around her, and he lost sight of her in the narrow, crowded streets of the caravanserai, where whole families were standing outside their homes to stare at the northern sky, and dust and litter whirled between the buildings as Airhaven dipped overhead, trying out its rotors one by one. There was a small stone house where someone found a seat for him, and a man in black robes and a big white turban who examined his bruised chest.
"Broken," he said cheerfully. "I am Ibrahim Nazgul, physician. 4 of your ribs are quite smashed up."
Tom nodded, giddy with the pain and shock, but starting to feel lucky that he was still alive, and glad that these people weren't the anti-tractionist savages he had been expecting. Dr. Nazgul wound bandages around his chest, and his wife brought a steaming bowl of mutton stew and helped Tom eat, spooning it into his mouth, Lantern light lapped at the corners of the room, and in the doorway the doctor's children stood staring at Tom with huge, dark eyes.
"You are a hero," explained the doctor. "They say you fought with an iron djinn who would have killed us all."
Tom blinked sleepily at him. He had almost forgotten the squalid little battle at the edge of the bog. The details were fading quickly, like a dream. "I killed Shrike," he thought. All right, so he was dead already, technically, but he was still a person. He had hopes, and plans, and dreams, and I put a stop to them all. He didn't feel like a hero. He felt like a murderer, and the feeling of guilt and shame stayed with him, staining his dreams as his head drooped over the bowl of stew, and he slipped away into sleep. Then he was in another room, in a soft bed, and there was a blustery blue-and-white sky beyond the window, and a patch of sunlight coming and going on the lime-washed wall.
"How are you feeling, stalker killer?" a voice asked.
Miss Fang stood over him, watching him with the gentle smile of an angel in an old picture. Tom said,
"Everything hurts. Well enough to travel? The Jenny Hanover is waiting, and I would like to be away before sundown. You can eat once we're airborne. I've made toad in the hole with real toad."
"Where's Hester?"
Tom asked groggily.
"Oh, she's coming too."
He sat up, wincing at the sharp pain in his chest and the memory of all that had happened.
"I'm not going anywhere with you," he said.
The aviatrix laughed, as if she thought he was joking, then realized he wasn't, and sat down on the bed, looking concerned.
"Tom, have I done something to upset you?"
"You work for the League," he said angrily. "You're a spy, no better than Valentine. You only helped us because you hoped we'd tell you things about London."
Miss Fang's smile faded entirely.
"Tom," she said gently, "I helped you because I like you. And if you had seen your family slave to death aboard a ruthless city, might you not have decided to help the League in its fight against municipal Darwinism?"
She reached out to brush the tousled hair away from his forehead, and Tom remembered something he had forgotten, a time when he was little and very ill, and his mother had sat with him like this. But the badge of the League was still on Miss Fang's breast, and the wound of Valentine's betrayal was still raw. He would not let himself be tricked by smiles and kindness again.
"You kill people," he said, pushing her hand away. "You sank Marseille."
"If I had not, it would have attacked the Hundred Islands, killing or enslaving hundreds more people than I drowned with my little bomb."
"And you strangled the raisin of somewhere or other."
"The Sultana of Palau Pinang?"
The smile came flickering back.
"I didn't strangle her. What a horrible suggestion. I simply broke her neck. She let amphibious raft cities refuel at her island, so she had to be disposed of."
Tom didn't see that it was anything to smile about. He remembered Raylan's men slumped in the shadows of the air quay at Staines, and Miss Fang telling him they were just unconscious.
"I may be no better than Valentine," she went on, "but there is a difference between us. Valentine tried to kill you, and I want to keep you alive. So, will you come with me?"
"Where to?"
asked Tom suspiciously.
"To Shan Guo," she replied. "I'm willing to bet that what lit up the sky last night had something to do with the thing Valentine took from Hester's mother, and I have learned that London is heading straight for the Shield Wall."
Tom was amazed. Could the Lord Mayor really have found a way to breach the League's borders? If so, it was the best news for years. As for going to Shan Guo, that was the heart of the Anti-Traction League, the last place in the world a decent Londoner should go.
"I won't do anything to help you harm London," he told her. "It's still my home."
"Of course,"
she replied.
But if the wall is about to be attacked, don't you think the people who live behind it deserve a chance to get away? I am going to warn them of their danger, and I want Hester to come with me and tell her side of the story. And Hester will only go if you come too.
Tom laughed and found that it hurt.
I don't think so,